Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
To an emerging forest, a safe place where we have the freedom to think about life without judgment. We take a look at society, we examine it, and we allow for the possibility of something new, something different. And now, here's your host, Alan Ritter.
Well, welcome everybody to this Sunday, December 17th, 2017. About many more Sundays left. In 2017, I think there are two, in fact. It's going to be an interesting New Year's Eve show, I'll tell you. And it's 9 o'clock, and we have until 11 to talk. And this week, my very special guest is Janice Taylor. And she... She has a particular interest in her life, and it happened to coincide with some place that she went and opened her eyes. So, hi, Janice. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also, David Whitman has joined us. Hi, David. How are you?
How's it going, Alan?
Great. I'm glad, so super glad that all three of us can get together. And I'd like to remind the listeners out there that this is a live broadcast program. If you are listening right now as I speak, well, how are you going to tell? You're listening on recording. Okay, if you're listening on the day that this was actually recorded, you can call in. And I encourage people to call in, because I know that what Janice is going to talk about is probably going to trigger some things in people. So the call-in number is 646-564-9714. So I encourage anyone and everyone who wants to call in and talk to the three of us. So I wanted to talk, or I wanted you to sort of tell your story, Janice, and maybe if it sounds reasonable, you'd want to start with sort of, okay, what are the foundations? Who are you, and what are you bringing to the table as far as, quote-unquote, a wide-eyed, naive trip to Prague?
Interesting. Wide-eyed, naive trip. So, let's see. So I went to Prague on holiday maybe like 3 months ago now. I went there in September. I would say I have a passing interest in the occult, going so far as to say I'm a practicing occultist at this point. I never really knew that Prague was a hotbed for alchemy or anything about the really rich history that Prague has, both in terms of architecture and art and all of the historical events that have happened around there. It was just really strange to see something coinciding, you know, my personal life that I've been studying all along, I'd say.
Right. So it's interesting to look at our personal quote unquote passions, and then you just happen quote unquote to be taking a trip to Prague, and you step from your you step from one classroom into an applied field of research, right?
Right, right. It was just very happenstance. I definitely didn't plan it. Planned it any better. You know, I was expecting a very normal kind of sightseeing sort of trip. Wasn't really looking forward to going, actually, because I had so many things going on at home in terms of reading, you know, friends, hobbies. Like, I just felt like I had a really busy schedule, and I was like, oh, I have to travel. I usually travel a lot anyway in my personal life. Even though it's going on holiday, I was just kind of like, well, I wasn't looking forward to being away from home. I just kind of wanted to stay home and sort of just kind of like buckle down, just kind of relax a little bit at home. So, you know, I went, and it was really surprising. It was a lot more informative than I thought it would be. Architecture is definitely really interesting. I saw some interesting landmarks there that I can talk about.
What were some landmarks?
However
that you saw?
Hello? That, David?
What were some landmarks that you saw?
Landmarks. Let me see. So Prague is known for alchemy, in the very traditional sense of turning lead into gold. There's also a spiritual alchemy that's involved, but right now we're going to look at the very literal sense. Medieval alchemy, which is when they would decide they would experiment scientifically. And maybe around 2 years ago, there was a flood underneath one of the buildings in Prague, and the flood had uncovered a laboratory, like a medieval work. I don't want to say the word working because it was obviously sealed because it became illegal. But basically, Rudolf II was their ruler who encouraged occult studies and made all that permissible. So when he kind of opened the gate to, you know, okay, if you're interested in this, you can come here where it's legal and it's open and you'll meet other people who are into it. And it used to be, a very underground thing. In medieval Europe, I mean, people would, you know, be burned at the stake, and the churches would prosecute people who are into any of the occult studies, witchcraft, ceremonial magic, what have you. So it was definitely forbidden in a lot of places. So this is one place where it was actually open. And because of that openness and that welcoming, a lot of people traveled there. Edward Kelly traveled there. It just became like a hotbed of knowledge just because it was so open. So this tunnel was discovered maybe 2 years ago. They hadn't known about it since. And they'd kind of excavated parts of the tunnel and opened it up to the public. So you could see that, like, really narrow tunnels. You could see parts of the distillery that they use in terms of cleaning bottles, drying herbs. So I did go to an alchemy museum when I was there. Just what I'm talking about. Some tapestries, some paintings, a little bit about the history of the place. And there was also a tunnel they'd found in that underground laboratory that connected to the castle. So Prague Castle, which is where this ruler lived a long time ago, he had like an underground tunnel that connected to this place.
Wow.
The tunnel sounds interesting. Go ahead, Alan.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Please.
So he had a direct communication with this facility. So one can draw the conclusion that it was not only was the above ground open practice of alchemy allowed, but the below-ground mythical practice of alchemy led to gold was something that he was very interested in.
Yes. So these were alchemists that were working for him. He sponsored them. So, yeah, so that's why there was a tunnel underneath leading to the castle. And I also suspect in terms of, because after his reign, alchemy became illegal again, or became discouraged, so that seal up all the tunnels. So I think part of it was also for secrecy, in case something like this were to happen, went from like, okay, now it's allowable, and then suddenly, like, you know, 5-8 years later, it's not. That's not really a very huge span of time when you think about it in terms of scientific discovery. So they had to kind of have a way where, okay, if we need to seal this back up and cut and bury it, literally, well, no pun intended, bury it, we can, right? We can just seal up these tunnels. And nobody knew about this alchemy lab until that building started flooding, actually. And the building is maybe, I'm trying to think how many miles. It's not that far. Maybe it's like a 40-minute walk from the castle. So it's not that far away. That's not like, it's not right next to the castle. So it's quite a ways off if you were to walk it.
Yeah, so it's about 2 miles, which is about 40 minutes, which is, from a perspective of underground tunneling, that's quite a ways.
Ryan, you're also thinking back then they didn't have like the modern machines we had to build these tunnels. So it would have taken a lot more work to actually. This is like a very intentional thing that they built, right? I mean,
well, it wasn't.
So they had
no, very. What was that?
Well, I'm saying it wasn't an accident. They had a plan. I mean, they're not going to build tunnels for no reason.
Right.
And obviously, you know, there was some reasons for this, and more than likely. Part of it was the fact it was probably not, they were probably trying to raise some kind of financial. You know, if you turn some lead into gold, you're going to have a pretty good lead on other countries, and they're going to be able to purchase some goods. So I'm sure
it
was all related to the greater good of Prague.
Mm-hmm.
Pragmatic reason, you know. I think behind most things there's pragmatic reasons. But I'm curious to know more about what the architecture was around outside. What did you notice? What did any kind of symbology that stuck out to you?
Okay, so I noticed a lot of sculptures in the facades of the building, usually above the doorway, and this is left over from medieval times. Above the doorway, there'd be some sort of sculpture or some sort of figural decoration. I've seen all kinds of things from a white swan, which is an alchemical symbol. Hold on, I'm going through my photos now. There's a white swan. There's a lion, which is another one. Different things are hidden, like, they couldn't exactly, like, announce, you know, that alchemy was done here, even though it was legal at some point. So they would have little, like, coded symbols, where if you knew what the symbols meant, you would kind of understand what they were. One of them was golden scale. So golden scales meant there's also alchemy done there. Golden wheel. Looking through the rest of these. Just a lot of hidden things.
Mm-hmm.
Hidden in terms of like hidden in plain sight. There's a golden wheel.
If you knew what you were looking for, you'd see it.
Right. If you knew what you were looking for, you'd see it. There's a golden chalice. And these facades were left over. I'm sure now there may be a couple of tourist books. But it was really cool to see this all preserved and to think, okay, you know, now maybe it's a coffee shop or something now. And now it's not like that on the inside, but imagine back then when everything else was still the way it was. We've been pretty cool to see. I also saw Edward Kelly's Tower. So Edward Kelly and John Dee worked on Enochian magic together, angelic magic. And they're both from London. But Edward Kelly had set up shop in this tower, and I think Dee joined him like a couple of times there. But he had like set up shop in this basically a tower to just kind of work. And they had turned the tower into a museum. So you had to climb the stairs. It's like a circular staircase, kind of narrow, kind of, you know, not falling apart, obviously, because it's a museum now. So it has to be stable. So I'm guessing they rebuilt all of the stairs, but definitely narrow. It's definitely 80 plus steps to go up. And it's, you know, you constantly hunch over. And upstairs was a reenactment of his laboratory. So they had a lot of alembic flasks, a lot of his books. He worked on the homo nucleus when he was there, like the humanoid, basically experimentation. It was just really cool to see that, okay, this is a real building where once upon a time, many years ago, somebody actually did magical research here. And a really strange energy to it. It obviously is different because it's a museum, so you have a lot of people coming in because, oh, it's just on some tour, you know, tour guide, not really appreciating what they're seeing. But it's really different when you're sort of studying that thing yourself and then you see, you know, oh, hey, these are people who I read about. And this is actually, these are actually places where they've been.
That's very exciting.
I thought that was really interesting. Let's see, other symbols I noticed were the all-seeing eye. So that's a Masonic symbol as well. And
it's on our dollar bill.
Yes, yeah, it's on the dollar bill. It's the eye inside the triangle. So I saw that it's the eye of providence. I did see this on the top of an obelisk, like in a church or right next to a church. It seemed to be everywhere. This all-seeing eye, everywhere if you knew how to look for it or where to look for it. And I remember on my last day when I was in Prague, I actually had a dream that, you know, I was photographing these eyes because I was actually doing this in real life. So every time I see one, I photograph and kind of collect photographs of these eyes. And then my dream, the eyes were watching me. So it was kind of saying to me, okay, we know that you know what we are, and guess what? We also know what you are. It was this very strange, like, two-dimensional, I don't want to say conversation. It was a conversation without words. So it was really interesting dream about Prague, my last day of being there.
How the subconscious works in many ways.
Right.
I had a question about the Sphinx. I'm looking at the photo right now. Where was that at? Mm-hmm. That's a really, really nice sculpture.
The Sphinx was... next to a library. I think it's either, I didn't go into this building, but there's basically a doorway flanked by two sphinxes. And I believe it's a modern museum now, but I didn't go in. All right, so the Sphinx is another, you know, ancient Egyptian creature. And one common tenet they always say is like, you know, to know, to dare, to will. Oh, hold on. Hold on a second. Let me get that delivery. All right, hold on.
Oh, okay.
Hello. Hey, there's some up. Thank you. All right. So anyway, the Sphinx, they always say, you know, it's a creature from ancient Egypt, the head of a woman, correct me if I'm wrong, David, the head of a woman, head in the torso, sorry, of a woman. The paws of a lion, so the bottom half would be of a lion, and the tail is something else, right? Is it a lion's tail, or is it a different animal?
I believe it's the same. I'd have to double check. It's interesting that sculpture probably wouldn't be allowed in the States because it shows her bare breasts.
Oh, I didn't even notice that actually. I didn't realize that we weren't allowed to have sculptures like that. Okay, so in Greek tradition, it's the head of a human, the paws of a lion, sometimes the wings of a bird, but I think this one didn't have any wings.
It didn't appear to. I'm looking at it right now.
Right. It just looks like a lion. Yeah.
And where was that at, in front of the museum?
That was in front of a modern museum. It's a modern art museum now, but it's obviously a very old call. I don't even know if old is the right word, considering old in Prague means something different to us here in the New World. Very classical structure, which also has magical meaning. So anyway, the rules of the Sphinx, to know, to dare, to will, and to keep silent. You know, you may hear that being talked about.
Well, and there's the riddle of the Sphinx, right? Which is
that's right, right.
Is it,
riddle of the Sphinx, right? So it's a very common classical creature.
I noticed in this there's a Medusa sculpture. There's a lot of Greek look to Prague in some ways. At least this particular Medusa, it's very Greek looking. Do you know a lot of Greek architects are there?
I don't know. I'm guessing maybe. I also went to Prague is sort of small, so I think I was there for maybe like 10 days, which is a couple days too many. So I ended up going to Berlin and – no, sorry, not Berlin. I ended up going to Vienna and then Dresden, actually. So those are two separate – two separate days. So I just had like extra days. And while I was in Vienna, I ended up going to a Masonic exhibit, which it was another thing where like I didn't realize this Masonic exhibit was happening. I didn't plan it. I was just kind of like, okay, there's a day trip somewhere. It looks to be like close by and it's reasonable. So I'm just going to go there while I'm here. Oh, look, there's a Masonic exhibit happening at the same time.
What was that like?
It was really interesting. I mean, I went to one of their lodges. It was beautiful. It was old. A lot of information. And I believe the Masons had held it because people were so confused about what they were. So they wanted to inform people about what they were about.
What were some things that stood out to you in that?
Obviously they couldn't give too many things away, but they talked about the dollar bill, they talked about certain symbols. I'm trying to see if I can pull it up. Hold on a second. They talked about certain symbols, they talked about some of their initiations, not in, you know, great detail, of course, because they couldn't. But they talked about, they had these floor rugs. Either floor rugs or tapestries. I guess it would be floor rugs. So basically what would happen was you would lay out a direction, east, west, north, south. You would actually have this on the floor rug. And then you would just kind of lay the floor rug down and orient it whichever way your doorways and your windows, et cetera, were facing. And it saved them a ton of work, because directions were really important to them and the rituals they were doing. So because you just had this floor rug, you just kind of laid it out, and that saved people from, you know, drawing on the floor. It was portable. It was easy to hide. And I thought that was really interesting. They've sort of evolved to, like, a very I feel like it's a very modern concept, this whole, like, the mobile ritual room, so to speak. I feel like it's a very modern concept. So they've kind of evolved to have that. I think it was just interesting in terms of how they, I don't want to say they were defending themselves, but how they wanted to explain who they were. I don't think in America that would have been, like, if the Masons, I don't picture the Masons here ever having an exhibit like the Met or the MoMA, or, you know, it's just not, I feel like here's just not something they would do. Maybe as Americans we're different. It's kind of like we're allowed to have fraternal organizations. We don't have to explain ourselves. Because I know in Europe for a time it was considered negative if you were a Mason. People didn't really quite understand what they did. So because they didn't understand what they did, they were really suspicious of them. again, I think here in America, there's kind of less of that, right? I mean, our whole culture and country kind of preaches everybody's different, right? Different religions, different cultures, and just because you don't understand what your neighbor's doing doesn't mean you're going to condemn it.
In theory, but not in reality, no.
Right. In theory, right. So I think because of that, there's less of a, you know, we're not going to see any Masonic exhibits here.
Alan, did you have anything to ask?
No, I was interested in what was being said, and also interested in the fact that you went to Dresden. You went for a day or something?
Yeah, it was just, I think even like a half day. I don't think I saw anything noteworthy, but you know, Dresden was pretty, but compared to everything else I saw that actually I had a vested interest in, let's just say, it wasn't too super noteworthy. You know, beautiful gardens, mm-hmm. beautiful sculptures, but not anything Masonic or Enochian or, you know, no symbolism over there. It was just like a nice afternoon trip that wasn't Prague. That was basically it.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that during World War II, Dresden was one of the locations that was firebombed by the Allied Air Force. And they use a particular hot burning phosphorus incendiary, and it actually because it burns so hot and so quickly, it actually starts a storm because fires breathe and they pull in oxygen. So Dresden. Or parts of Dresden, I'm not sure of the history exactly, burned rather extensively.
Yeah, that's covered a great deal by Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse 5.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, they've definitely rebuilt it. I remember when I was there, they were talking about how they rebuilt a bunch of the buildings and how they were kind of recovered. I mean, it's been a long, long time, but, you know, it's definitely better now. But, yeah, I still think because of that, they don't get the brunt of the tourism. Because I know that's one thing I know about Prague is Prague was never bombed. So you have a lot of these medieval structures left, like St. Vitus Cathedral is still there. The Gothic Cathedral, St. Charles Bridge is still there. Because it was never bombed, you never really lost a lot of these older pieces the way you did in Dresden. It was just kind of interesting to see how the city's recovered, how people are. I definitely
I'm
feel like the people
at...
in...
Go ahead.
No, sorry. Go on.
I'm looking at one of your photos of the underground chemical lab at the Siculum Alchemy Prague. It's very interesting. It's quite a bit like you'd see at a chemist lab. So it looks very very tight quarters. Is that accurate? Tight.
Yeah. So everything looks small and cramped because it was small and cramped. I'm not sure if this is because building the tunnels, like it's really hard to build a tall, wide tunnel, or maybe space reasons. Like they kind of had to cram this into like the basement of a building. And it was actually when they buried it, people never found it until literally 2 years ago, and they found it by accident.
So this is what they found 2 years ago. This underground.
Right. And only by accident because there was a flood. So that area was flooding. Because it was flooding, they had to, like, open it up and fix it. And then they were like, oh, there's a lot of, like, old flasks here. And there's this huge, you know, not huge, but there's a tunnel here. I wonder what else is underneath that city then that they haven't been able to excavate. I mean, this is just what came to light recently. There could be all kinds of things in there that we're just not aware of.
I'm going to throw a photo on your site.
Hang on for a second. I think we can pick it up right here, but I'd like to take the break. So hang on, everybody. We're going to be right back after the break. The music is from Darv the Bard, Howl and Toe.
Take no scorn to wear the horn. Was the crest when you were born? Your father wore it, and your father wore it too. Howl and Toe, Johnny Rumble-o.
International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
Welcome back to An Emerging Forest on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We hope everyone was able to stretch their legs and get a drink. And now, back to Alan.
And now back to talking about an underground chemistry lab from the alchemic legal period in Prague. A chemistry lab, of course, not something I'm familiar with at all. So let's continue with that.
Okay. What were we talking about earlier? I think we're talking about how the tunnels were small.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. So it is as crabbed as it looks like in the pictures. again, I don't know if the smallness is because back then they didn't have our modern machines, or they intentionally kept it small because in case they had to seal it up, it was easier to seal up a tunnel that was smaller. I think maybe practical reasons.
Yeah, underground tunnels are classically, the bigger it is, yeah, I mean, back then especially, you're not going to have had the capability to open it up too much, and the expense is going to be much greater as you increase the size of the artificial cavern that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And safety is an issue.
Right. Fires also was a problem. It was all stone, so if there was a fire, it's probably fine. I mean, relatively fine, right? It's not like it's wooden or anything else that would have been contained.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, the other thing I've seen there was the new old synagogue in the Jewish quarter.
I was looking at an image of that just now.
Okay. So basically the story there is...
Can you describe it?
From the outside, it looks really nondescript. I'm looking for it now. I remember it being nondescript. I remember going in. It's smaller than it sort of looked. Very, like, it's not as ornate as, like, the churches you would see, obviously. A lot plainer. But the interesting thing about that is the legend of the golem that happened around that area. So the Jewish people the legend goes the Jewish people were facing a lot of anti-Semitism and basically bullying of their people. So the rabbi created this entity out of clay and gave him a purpose, and his purpose was to protect the Jewish people from being bullied or being discriminated against. And the golem kind of went around protecting them, and it was fine, you know, so everything was sort of peaceful and everything was harmonious. And then at some point the golem ran out of things to do because he'd been protecting them for so long that people basically didn't discriminate against them, not as much as they used to, and he had nothing to do. So the rabbi never gave him a new purpose. So because of that, he started getting sort of destructive, like just like overturning flower pots and just causing mischief. And he became a nuisance to the people, who then said to him, okay, you have to do something about this golem. He's, you know, he's protected us, and now there's nothing left to protect us from. Everything's fine now. So legend has it that they sealed him up. On top of the synagogue, there's these stairs, and there's a doorway kind of cut into, like, a ledge. So legend has it that he couldn't really be dismantled or wasn't dismantled, but that he's still there. He's just, so that triangular shape, picture
mm-hmm.
the roof, a triangular shape and the doorway that's cut into it and some stairs, that's supposedly where the golem is. So what happened was they've checked every place that the golem could be when they, like, I guess they need him for something else in the future. They checked every place, couldn't find him. And the only place they did not check was that attic. So that's the shape. That's the pyramid top in that picture with a doorway that's kind of cut into the roof with those. And those stairs are like, I would think it's really intimidating to climb those stairs. It's pretty high up. It's like a couple of stories up. It's like, you know, maybe four or five. It's pretty intimidating. The ledge is narrow. There's no like handrails. You know, I just don't think you should be climbing those stairs. But anyway, they haven't checked in there since who knows when. So the story is that he's in there.
I'm reading it. There's a recent legend. Well, there's a recent legend that tells of a Nazi agent who was sent in the synagogue during World War II and tried to stab the golem, but he died instead. And as you mentioned, the attic is not open to the general public. So still resting, I guess. I guess it was the late 16th century that this rabbi would have done this, Judah Lo Ben Bezalel. I'm probably mispronouncing his name.
Rabbi Lo?
Fascinating story.
Yeah, Rabbi Lo, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and the other thing they talk about is there's something called the Shem, which basically activates the golem.
Yeah.
And because it was... because it was Friday evening, he wasn't, like, he forgot to remove it because he thought the golem would desecrate the Sabbath. They're not supposed to do any work Friday evening on the Sabbath day. You're not supposed to do anything. So he thought you'd be breaking that rule by actually removing, like, deactivating him. So he just kind of stuck him up there. Or not up there, but he kind of just, like, hid him. So I know there's different stories that say he was never deactivated. And some stories say that he was. He was deactivated in front of the people, but that he was stored in the attic. And the legend I heard when I was there was that they didn't find the golem's body. And the only place that they didn't look was the attic. So they thought he was probably in the attic. Plus the way the doorway is and the way those stairs are. I mean, it kind of looks like there's something in there. Because it looks like it's accessible.
Right.
Somehow, right.
And you mentioned that supposedly the legend is that some of the stones came from Solomon's temple?
Yes, yes. That's the other thing, from the stones on the inside. Supposedly came from Solomon's temple, which is why it's called the New Old. So the old part is the ones that came from Solomon's temple, and the new part is everything they've built around it and surrounding it.
Hmm. What was it like inside?
It was really small. I kind of thought it would be bigger just because I guess the roof looked pretty big. Definitely small. They give like head coverings to the males who come in, so you have to cover your head if you're a male. Very plain, not a lot of ornamentation. I guess I'm comparing it to like St. Vitus Cathedral, but sort of plain. Again, it's different because I think when I went there, there's a lot of tourists coming in because it's in a lot of the guidebooks. So
sure.
I think the energy of a place is different. If there's like hundreds of people or, you know, one tour group of 20 people, another tour group of 20 people, and just like people cycling through that area, it's really different.
So the frequency of people in the synagogue was higher or lower than the tower?
The tower is not accessible at all.
Because of the stairs, right?
Right, because of the stairs, and they just, the stairs. So those stairs are not, like, I can't imagine bringing a family or a tour group over there to climb those stairs. The tower's not accessible. And I would say it had a high turnaround. I mean, it's a bunch of, like, different tour groups, like, you know, Jewish Prague or the history of Prague. It's a fairly popular place. It's kind of like the Empire State Building here in New York, right? It's kind of a popular place. And I think the energy of a place changes when there's a lot of people cycling through the place. You don't really get to – it didn't really feel holy, but I don't know if that's just because I'm not Jewish or if it's because there's so many people. Like, I've been in Catholic churches, you know, my family's Catholic, but I've been in a lot of churches where there's been a lot of people, and it doesn't feel holy either. It feels like a museum. Because at that point, people are treating it like a museum. I mean, they're going in, taking pictures, you know, Mass isn't being said anymore. It's kind of just like, okay, here's a way to preserve our old Gothic-style sculptures and mythology, maybe, and architecture, and it's not a place of worship anymore. It's more of a living museum. So the same thing happens in different churches.
A question regarding you also went to the Museum of Medieval Torture Instruments. That sounds like quite an experience.
Right, that was actually really heavy. I don't know what I was expecting going to a torture museum. I thought it would be like kind of a good break from all this. It's still historical, but I thought it would be like kind of amusing and interesting. It was really, really heavy. they had a lot of, first of all, there was nobody in there. So it was the polar opposite of the synagogue tour. Synagogue tour was very popular. This one had maybe five people in there, counting, me and my husband ended up going. So maybe five people. It was in another like darkened, not tunnel, but they purposely made it look creepy. I was expecting something more scientific. I know, it kind of seems kind of silly looking back now. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it was definitely creepy. They had some of the figures. They had like wax. They had like a wax figure of a witch burning at the stake. In case you didn't know what that meant, complete with like the fake screaming and the fake like fire behind her, and these instruments of torture came from all over, not just Prague. So I guess countries had donated their, their Iron Maidens and their, I don't know all the names for these contraptions, but they had donated a bunch of these to that museum.
And most of these were from Inquisition and things, or no?
Right. So a lot of really creative ways to torture people. They must have had a lot of spare time on their hands.
A lot of religious tolerance back then.
Right, and it must have been really frightening. I mean, it was frightening for me, and I'm looking at this, and I'm like, okay, this is a part of history, and it's not going to ever happen again, but I can only imagine knowing people, you know, in your small town, maybe knowing somebody who's accused or, you know, seeing them in the town square, like maybe it's somebody you buy vegetables from, it's just maybe an acquaintance of yours, going through this and seeing what it does to their family. It must have been really, really scary. And it must have scared people straight into religion.
Horrible, horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
Something with the imagination of a human mind can come up with.
Right, I'm trying to look through some pictures from that area. Hold on. Right, so this one is an Iron Maiden, which has it basically looks like an upright, I guess coffin is the right word, but the inside is all spikes, and the doorway has spikes on the inside. So they would basically kind of force you in there and then shut the door on you, so you'd have spikes on all sides. Plus, you'd be claustrophobic, it would be confined, it would be like a tight space, and then I'm pretty sure once you were in there, I think the version of Nuremberg, if I remember correctly, is what they called it. There was really like no getting out of that thing. I mean, once you're in there, you're kind of in there. And then, all of these like forced confessions of people, you know, they torture you until you basically confess. So who knows what you're saying is even the truth. It's just like, whatever. At that point, you'll say anything to not be put in that thing. It was scary in a different way in terms of that people really believed in the devil so strongly, or the existence of evil, whatever, so strongly they believe that they should torture their neighbors to prevent it from happening. This one looks like some guys being drawn and quartered, maybe. So it looks like a long stretcher. I didn't upload a ton of pictures of these, but his hands are pulled from the front, and his feet are pulled the other way, and they have like a rack, and they mechanically slowly pull you in different directions. So it's really painful and uncomfortable. And basically, if you don't confess, you're just going to pulling until you're dead. So it's kind of like you can confess and we'll stop torturing you. And then if you're lucky, we'll burn you at the stake, or we'll devise these like tests for you. Like a flotation test, like, okay, if you can float, then you're a witch, but if you sink, then you're not. Basically, it doesn't matter how well you do in the test; you're still going to die at the end of the day. It's just a question of how it's going to go.
very sad commentary on the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And what the human mind is capable of in the name of some higher belief. And much like the horrible things that have happened with the terrorists blowing themselves up.
Right, right. Well, yeah, they had a cause that they believed in and decided to go for that. Just like these people had a cause they believed in, which is the existence of witches, existence of the devil, and then they decided to just start torturing people. And I think part of it was peer pressure and fear also. The other picture I have is of a chair, and the chair has all these spikes on the seat of the chair and on the back of the chair and on the legs of the chair. And it's a similar concept to the Virgin of Nuremberg, which is all these spikes, except it's just a chair. You're just sort of sitting there bolted to the chair. That can't be pleasant either. I'm sure they put weights on you, make sure you don't move. I think once you're there, you're just kind of like there. There's really no getting out of something like that.
So, were there any lighter experiences?
Lighter experiences. There's an astrological clock that's interesting. It dates back from, I'm guessing, medieval era. Let me see if I can look it up. Yeah, it is a medieval, astronomical clock, and the interesting thing about it is, first of all, it's age. So to have like a huge, moving clock in the 1400s was a big deal. It's Gothic sculptures, and also it's supposed to mirror what's going on in the heavens based on medieval astronomy. They thought it was like a really primitive planetarium. So they had a zodiac, they had a 24-hour clock, they had when the sun would set, the planetary time, the planetary hours, which, even now if we had something like that would be really, really awesome, I think. And also not to mention all the art it was inlaid with, there's a lot of gold paint. It's sort of impressive. So you would have a crowd of people who would just kind of stand there and wait, usually like 5 or 10 minutes before people would kind of queue up and then start looking at the clock. And then you could see different. It was like a cuckoo clock, right? The door would open and the figures would come out and they would rotate and then the door would close again. And then that would be like nothing for, another hour or so. So you would have tourists constantly lining up and waiting.
So there's literally like clockwork, but it's waiting for a particular planetary or astrological event or time to occur, and then the figure comes out announcing the time, and it just goes back in, and it's whatever
mm-hmm.
figure was
right.
is, okay, Saturn comes out or Neptune comes out or whatever comes out, right?
Right, right. I remember it was really underwhelming. The thing is, you're in that square and you're waiting. You're standing there maybe 20 minutes before so you could get in front of the clock, and then you're sort of waiting. And then the whole thing finishes in maybe like a minute. It's like watching the ball drop, New Year's, it was all this build up, and then the figures change, and that's literally like not even 30 seconds.
That is one of the biggest wastes of time there is.
Yeah, but it's kind of like when you're there on holiday, you're kind of like, okay, I should probably see this, because it's all the guidebooks. But yeah, it really sort of is a waste of time.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the ball dropping.
Oh, the ball drop,
the ball drop is a waste
okay.
of time.
Okay.
Excuse to get
yeah,
drunk
that
in Times
that
Square.
Yeah, that was great, yes. But we're also local, so I feel like as locals we have more of a... Yeah, definitely the only people in front of that clock was definitely all tourists, of course. You don't see any locals like lining up watching the figures change.
Oh, I see a picture of the clock now. I'm on your page.
Right. Right. So they have the Zodiac.
Detail, that is amazing.
Right. They have the Zodiac. They have sidereal time. They have the normal time. They have the sunset, the sunrise. It's all very visual, which is great.
The lower circle looks vaguely Tibetan, but that's just my view.
Hmm.
I'm sure that's not the case. It's plants. Mm-hmm. It looks Tibetan. It's not, of course, but it could be influenced somewhat.
Hmm.
And where was this at again?
This was at the, I want to say it's the main square. It's probably not called the main square, but there's only like one square there. Here it is. Old Town Square. So basically in Prague you had the Jewish quarter, you had, the Alchemy Museum was kind of like a hole in the wall. Like it's really small. It's not near any of the touristy areas. Prague
mm-hmm.
Castle is very touristy because it's an obvious castle, so people go in. There's a cathedral, St. Vitus Cathedral's in there. A lot of really cool Gothic architecture, sculptures, just overwhelming amount of sculptures and artwork. I don't even think I took pictures of that just because it was just overwhelming. And that you could, like, St. Vitus Cathedral would take you, like, maybe a whole day just going in there, wandering around, looking at things. We had other museums inside St. Vitus Cathedral, so they had relics from the old emperors. And the other thing I saw was Kutnohora, also known as an ossuary.
In Prague?
Basically, outskirts of Prague. So maybe the second page or the third page, there's right at the very bottom. It's like a chapel of bones. So they basically hired somebody. They had all these bones, the ossuary. Basically what happened was everybody wanted to be buried there because they had returned, somebody had brought back some earth from Golgotha, where Jesus was crucified, and decided to sprinkle it over the Abbey Cemetery. And then in the 1300s, they had the Black Death, so everybody was dying, right? So everybody wanted to be buried there. So they just kind of shoved everybody in there. And it's this really tiny church. But obviously, these are like dead people's bones, right? You can't just toss them out. So what happened was this wood carver was charged by a family to put the bone heaps in order, kind of organize them. And at this point, this is like in the 1870s, you're talking about like centuries of bones at this point. Skeletons and bones, and it's not like an organized, tidy cemetery where everyone has a marker and everyone has a little shelf vault. So he kind of just did something cool and artistic. I mean, I think it's cool. Some people think it's macabre, or probably is, but whatever. I like stuff like that. He decorated it as best as he could using the bones. So you go in, there's a little narrow tunnel, it's all these tunnel, and there's a kind of like a little coat of arms with a cross, human bones, because he had to use them somehow. He couldn't just kind of leave them. Imagine like a pile of bones. So he had to make it somewhat nice. So he built a chandelier, some garlands, all these, you see like all these skulls strung together, candelabra, candle holders, a huge 6-8 feet tall candle holders with like metal and steel and little bones decorated on the side. a coat of arms of the family. The family had employed him, so he redid the coat of arms using bones.
Mm.
Very, very creative. I mean,
over 40,000 to 70,000 people.
Mhm. Right, so those are the noteworthy things: the chandelier, the coat of arms. When you come in, there's like a little chalice. It's not little, it's like maybe 8 feet, but it's a chalice made out of human bones. He just basically used whatever, like, his imagination could use and all these bones and was like, okay, I don't want to just, like, pile them all up. He did end up just piling all of them up in the end, but he wanted to make something nice and kind of, like, pretty. Pretty is the wrong word, but, you know, ornamental from from the bones. I thought it was beautiful, but that's just me. I thought it was really creative and... You know, I don't know if somebody would have done a better job if some random nobleman was like, here's a task of organizing these bones, and we don't know who they are, but you can't throw anyone out, you can't cremate them. You have to leave them here, stack them, because that's what we said we would bury them, and you can't throw anyone out, so you just have to do your best and make it look pretty. And he came up with this, which is great, I think.
And his signature, I guess, is there on the wall near the entrance.
Right, so that's him, that's Rint. Right, so he also spelled out his signature in bones. I remember I was leaning too close to one of the vaults while I was trying to take a selfie when I was here, and I set off the alarm, which is, of course, really embarrassing because they're all looking at, like, who's taking the bones? I'm like, sorry, I just leaned too close to one of the dead guys. Yeah, I wanted to be there for a selfie, and right.
Can't take you anywhere.
I know. Yeah, that was sort of embarrassing.
It was the American. It was the American.
It's always the American who's causing trouble, right?
And I see some images from murals from the Santa Barbara Church.
Santa Barbara Church?
Barbary, it looks like.
Oh, those medieval murals, right. So there is another church that was right next to Kutnahora that I've looked at. It's kind of hard because, I mean, I've seen, like, tons of churches at this point. So they all kind of blend in. A lot of them are still in the process of being restored. But it was cool to see gargoyles. I feel like we don't have that many gargoyles, like real, I don't say the word real, but you know, gargoyles that they thought would actually were going into the church. It's very interesting, like old concept.
I wanted to mention about... You're talking about the primary site of coin minting.
Oh, that was also, I think that was next to, might have been next to Kutnahora also.
And that's what these images are of coinsmiths.
Oh, right.
The
I
mural
I'm
looking
okay,
at.
So that, okay, I remember that. So that mural had coinsmiths. And then that town that church was from was actually known for minting medieval coins, which they had to do by hand. So ask somebody. So I do metalsmithing as a hobby. And I can definitely appreciate somebody sitting there stamping out coins by hand all day with your hammer and with your block all day with no ear protection. So I thought that was really interesting. I could definitely appreciate that. Let me think, what else? They have a lot of art. Santa Barbara. Oh, is this one you were talking about the lady?
Yes.
So they had a lot of reliquaries there. I guess it was a thing back then to just kind of go off to where the saints were from and kind of collect pieces of saints, if that makes any sense, so they could venerate them, and so the churches would be known to have something. This interesting one is, let me see, Saint Wilgefortis, who was a crucified and bearded female saint. So the legend has it that Saint Wilgefortis was a very pious woman, and her a heathen king demanded that she marry him, and she didn't want to marry him. So she prayed, and she took a vow of virginity, and she prayed for a miracle that she wouldn't have to marry him. So during her prayer, she ended up growing a beard somehow, like a very long, and in the cruise, in the picture of her, picture the statue of her is, she has a long beard and long hair, long beard, and because of the beard, the engagement was called off. But the father who had arranged her marriage to the heathen king was so upset that he had her crucified. So she's usually,
No, continue. I said,
Right. So she's actually really easy to. She's a medieval. I actually don't know of anybody who worships Saint or who prays to Saint Wilgefortis now. But in like her paintings, she's always seen with one shoe off. And the shoe, so while she's crucified, there's a shoe that kind of falls off from her feet or from her foot. And supposedly the shoe dropping off spontaneously at the feet of one of the pilgrims who goes to visit her. And the fiddler, the devotee, being a fiddler, I'm not quite sure why fiddler is... interesting, but I just noticed that she's a patron saint of unhappily married women, and I didn't actually know this because I thought because of her name it's like, oh, she's an icon to strong women everywhere. So, you know, me being Catholic by heritage, actually did pray to her when I was there. I, you know, gave her some money and I lit a candle and I knelt down, you know, did all the usual prayer stuff. And I was like, yeah, I've never heard of you before, but you're badass. You escaped an unhappy marriage. Okay, yeah, you got crucified. It sucked, but you didn't get married to this guy that, you know, you don't want to be married to. And, you know, for somebody in the 1300s, whatever, that was the best you could do, right? So good on you. And not a lot of people were praying. Nobody was praying to her, actually. It was kind of, I felt kind of sad. I was like, here's somebody that people venerated and had a statue of, and that was a big deal. And here, like, nobody cares. Nobody even remembers her. So I felt kind of bad, you know, and she's a woman and I'm another woman. So there's always that kind of like, we don't have a lot of female saints who are known for being strong women. So the fact that she was one, so it's funny looking back now that I realize she's actually a patron saint of women who are unhappily married.
That is interesting.
Well, good for you for giving her some energy.
Yeah, I mean, even though they're old symbols, I think a lot of these saints will have a lot of power. Even though the symbols are old and forgotten now and not quite so popular anymore.
Well, the age of them and the, you know, all the energy that was poured into them would obviously still be present.
Right.
Like so a fine wine would age, right?
Right.
I see an image of the Black Madonna in Prague. That's interesting. You can say more about that. The Cubist building, right? House of the Black Madonna in Old Town.
Right. So the Black Madonna statue is actually, it's sort of a little bit out of the way. It would be by like maybe the second or third story. And if you didn't know where it was, you would kind of miss it. You would have to either like walk by the square multiple times. So it's maybe a couple of like feet away from the astronomical clock. So by the Old Town Square, if you could go down to like their street, it's there. But again, if you don't know where it is, you could miss it. Let me see if I can pull up my notes on not much for
$500 black Madonnas in Europe, actually, which is interesting.
Yeah, they're not very common. They definitely stood out because of their dark, like, features and just all the gold. So anytime you see that, like, black and gold combination, it's really striking, I think. So there aren't that many.
And was that
the only one,
that image that you saw that was outside?
Yeah, that was the only one that was outside. I'm actually not even quite sure as to the origin of the Black Madonna. I just know it's really, really unusual. I guess they're saying some are associated with miracles. I'm not quite sure what this one really was associated with. I'm sure something. I know they say it's in the Cubist building.
It's the Church of Our Lady under the chain. The Madonna of Bresnice. It's an interesting mix of architecture and spirituality is present in Prague, isn't there?
Right, right. More so than most cities. And I was reading something when I came back, something about the white magic triangle cities happen to be New York, London, and Prague is the third one. So a lot of cities being interconnected. London, New York, and Prague.
Or what?
The white magic triangle cities, in terms of cities that have a lot of history, probably Enochian magic.
Interesting is the House of Black Madonna was originally designed to house a department store.
Mm-hmm.
God. Is there anything else you wanted to add about your time in Prague, Janice?
I would say no. It was good to get out of the city. It was good to learn new things. It was good to see these places firsthand. That's definitely an experience it was definitely more fun than I thought it would be. I recommend traveling when you can, if you can. And just being open-minded and paying attention. I guess part of this whole point of this trip was learning to kind of see what's already in front of you. It's not just about being in the right environment at the right time. It's also learning to recognize what's sort of in front of you when it's there. And have a lot of these symbols are sort of just everywhere. It's kind of like hidden in plain sight. So that's the interesting thing about it.
Thank you. Here I am. The frog is actually croaking. thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time to having been on a program that was not to be at an earlier time, and now we're finally able to follow up and make this happen. So. Thank you so much for your patience, and also for actually being on the program and talking about your trip.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you, Janice.
Mhm.
So, David, how do folks get in touch with you? Offline
by email.
Or off air.
My email, dwhitman0906@gmail.com.
And are you interested in receiving contacts as a result of this program, Janice?
I think I'm all right. If you can contact me through David, we're friends, so if there's any questions about Prague or alchemy or anything that might be interesting,
That's a very nice solution to that.
Right.
My host is Alan Ritter, and I run a small produce club co-op in the southeastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey area. And we can be contacted via the produceclub.us, just produceclub.us, and it's a page on Facebook. My email address is RITGER.ALAN88@gmail.com, and you can either contact me with questions about this program, wishes to be on a future program, or about the Produce Club, or anything else that's on your mind about your life passion. And if you want to talk about how you can pursue your life passion, and your life passion always opens up in front of you and continues and shows you signs and pulls you in, just like one of Janice's passions basically opened up in front of her in Prague and said, Ooh, there's lots more stuff here that's super interesting. And aren't you glad that you opened up those books and dusted off that knowledge that you did? So thanks, everybody, for being my guest tonight. And with that, I welcome everybody to listen to the program next week, which will be a program discussing net neutrality with myself and David. I believe that's correct, right, David?
Well, net neutrality got voted down, but we can still talk about it.
Well, we can. It's a subject that needs to be discussed, correct?
Yes.
All right. So have a great week, everybody, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.